Fisher.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, May 18th, 2009. First item on the agenda today will be a public hearing on Senate Bill 227A.
Senate Bill 227A increases the fine for knowingly furnishing alcohol to a minor or someone who is visibly intoxicated and allows for community service as an option to reduce the fines. It had no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued.
Rennell Shankle, please.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ronelle Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office, here today in support of Senate Bill 227A, and I can be very brief. Committee staff are passing out written testimony on this. It comes to you from our Attorney General Underage Drinking Task Force that convened during the last interim. It's similar to the bill you heard last session, and that has been significantly amended in the first chamber and is not nearly as exciting as it may have first seemed. Nonetheless, it is still important. Last week you heard about minors in possession. This week we're talking about furnishing and the laws and penalties related to people who provide alcohol to minors. As you can see in the A engrossed version, in essence what we have in the bill is a small increase in the fines for furnishing alcohol to minors. And I can walk you through the sections if you wish to do so, but in essence, we've increased the fines slightly. There was a lot of dialogue. We went up and down and back and forth and landed on this number. We also have community service provision as an alternative, but only in those areas where it's available, so it's discretionary. And we've maintained all of the existing provisions that give exclusions to parents and guardians. So I'll just stop there and see if you have questions or want to walk any further through this bill.
Questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I do. Thank you. I guess, Rennell, I'm curious with the potential of people doing community service. There wasn't consideration from fiscal on this for reduction.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, in essence what we did, there were some community service provisions available as additional penalties to the courts in the existing law, or there is today. What we added is the ability, which will now be in the new subsection 6, instead of the increased penalty amount, the court may waive up to $200 or one-thirds of the fine in lieu of letting them do community services if it's available. So we understand that would only occur in communities where it's already taking place, and so those costs are already built into that community because the community service programs exist. We do not think that it needs to be done statewide because that's certainly not in place everywhere.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're ready now. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Okay, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 227 and open a work session on Senate Bill 227.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 227 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 227 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith? Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Whitman? Excuse.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson will be the carrier. Okay. Jump to 3 then.
Mm-hmm. Saturday. I love it.
Before I close that, Representative Wilson, we just voted on 227. You have to vote aye.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to vote aye.
Representative Wisner votes aye. Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 227. Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 786. I'm sorry, public hearing on Senate Bill 786.
Senate Bill 786A enacts the Oregon Workplace Religious Freedom Act, requires an employer to reasonably accommodate religious practices of employees, makes violations unlawful and local employment discrimination. Allows employees to use vacation time, wear religious clothing, and take time off for religious practice. Employers must reasonably accommodate unless accommodation causes an undue hardship. Those factors to consider for hardship clarify school district does not commit unlawful employment practice by prohibiting teachers from wearing religious clothing while teaching. This had no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay, Mr. Hamilton, Labor Commissioner Avakian, and Speaker Hunt, please.
Dave Hunt. Senate Bill 786 comes to you because this is, in fact, for the returning House members, this will look very familiar to you. The House passed this by a very large margin in 2007. It went over and did not, it passed very late in the session in the House, didn't make it out of committee in the Senate. But it now started as a Senate bill this year. It really comes out of the fundamental challenge that we face with increasing claims of religious discrimination in the workplace. If you look at the federal numbers, Commissioner Avakian can talk about the specific state experience, but the federal numbers, just between 1992 and 2007, claims of religious discrimination filed with the federal EEOC more than doubled from 1,388 claims to 2,880. Part of the challenge is we're becoming a much more religiously pluralistic society. Issues of discrimination in the workplace have just become more frequent. This bill is very intentionally narrowly tailored to protect leave for religious observance and the wearing of religious clothing, only when that is required by a religion. Obviously, it has to be a bona fide religion, and it has to be a key tenet of that bona fide religion in order to have this protection. It also gives employers, in terms of balancing, as so often these church-state issues try to do, it has an intentional out clause, you might call it, for employers. If they can demonstrate that they have done everything possible to offer a reasonable accommodation and that it would be an undue hardship for that employee to be gone or to wear that clothing, then they have an out. They do not have to allow free exercise of religion in that particular instance. On the Senate side, Associated Oregon Industries brought forward a specific proposal which was amended in, which further clarified the phrase reasonable accommodation. And it really is trying, I think the bill as it stands now meets that balance test of having a reasonable accommodation, something that gives the opportunity for workers, for employees, to be able to freely exercise their religion, and to be able to have a job, and yet protects employers from having that be an undue hardship on their business. The standard that's adopted here may look familiar to you because the standard is the exact same standard that's utilized in the disability discrimination statute. And so that whole issue of reasonable accommodation and undue hardship are the exact same words and language from the disability statute, 659A.112. And so it's a tried and true standard that's already in place and has worked well in terms of allowing people with disabilities, workers with disabilities, to be able to work, and yet still also allowing employers to be able to make sure that they can get the job done in their workplace. And with that, I will yield to my two learned colleagues.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Brad Avakian, State Labor Commissioner. As Labor Commissioner, I lead the state's Bureau of Labor and Industries, which includes the state Civil Rights Division. This is the division which is the state's chief law enforcement agency for protecting people's civil rights, and will be the division that implements and enforces this new statute if it passes. We are fully supportive of Senate Bill 786. Always important when you have a policy that affects both employees and employers that you strike the appropriate balance. Senate Bill 786 does strike the balance between ensuring the rights of workers to practice, observe their religion, and also providing an outlet for employers to prove undue hardship when necessary, to provide them flexibility. In addition to it being the same standard that you find in disability statutes, it's also found in other administrative rules and statutes in a number of different areas, most notably the wage and hour laws that Oregon has as well. So it's a standard that is tried and true that our agency has been implementing for many, many years. We often think of these types of protections for religion, religious observance and practice as being First Amendment type issues under the United States Constitution. The difference between this and that is that the United States Constitution applies only to government action. It doesn't apply in situations of a private company with private employees. This very appropriately takes the same foundational theme that we have had in this country since the country's inception and applies it not only to public bodies, to private entities too, and does it in a very appropriate way. And for those reasons, the Bureau of Labor fully supports Senate Bill 786.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Speaker Dave Hunt and Brad Avakian have spoken very eloquently about this. My name is Greg Hamilton. I'm president of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association, and the only thing I'd like to add is that our organization mediates a lot for people in Oregon in the workplace. 319 mediation cases to date from 2005 until 2009 in May. And the only thing I would like to add is that this bill essentially defines undue hardship. Undue hardship has been without a real solid definition for employers to work with or for employees to appeal to. And so this bill takes care of that. With a language of significant difficulty and expense, it actually provides some definition, some guidance to both employers as well as employees seeking an accommodation. And as Speaker Hunt mentioned, it basically says, hey, employers, it's not good enough to just wave a magic wand and say, hey, this is an undue hardship. There needs to be some attempt to accommodate and then an explanation given. If they can't accommodate, obviously they can't accommodate. So that's essentially what this bill is about. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the committee? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Avakian, sir. Several years back, there were, when I was with the state police, I was involved with the recruiting and also the recruit training program. One of the recruits that had been hired, we didn't find this out until well advanced into the training, was opposed to working on a specific day of the week. I mean, when you need to be out there working 24 hours a day and you don't know what day of the week it's going to be, that created a serious problem. Do you see this Section 2, Sub 4 fitting into that then, in a situation like that?
Let me speak more to what the process would be in making that decision, and let me preface the whole thing with this. Because that was a government body, you would have not just this statute that would be applicable, but also the constitutional issues, which might have a slightly different standard. But with respect to this particular statute, the process we would go through is that the individual would be claiming the right to observe that particular day. As a religious day for them, we would turn to whether or not there was an undue hardship on the employer, and the employer would provide evidence according to the standards that are in, that at least include the standards that are in this statute, and then we would make a decision whether or not, based on the guidance of the principles in the statute, whether or not an undue hardship existed. If an undue hardship did exist, then the individual would not be able to use that day in observance. If the hardship did not exist, then their right would prevail. That's the process we would use.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For any of the three of you, what is your understanding or intention with this bill of what would happen if a requested accommodation conflicted with a collective bargaining agreement that an employer was bound by. Which of those two would or should take precedence?
Well, you need to give me just a minute to make sure, but all of this is going into 659.030. All of 659 is superseded by collective bargaining agreements. So unless there's something in this bill, and I don't think there is, that would change that, collective bargaining agreements would supersede.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question perhaps for Commissioner Avakian. Commissioner, you certainly know this area of law far better than I believe any of us do. I think I heard sort of somewhat, not contradictory, but statements from you and also from Mr. Hamilton that were somewhat in tension. You described this bill as essentially extending the law as is and the standards, i.e. what is a reasonable accommodation, what is an undue hardship. But Mr. Hamilton, I think, pointed out correctly that actually one of the possible benefits of this is that it does provide some statutory definition. Do you see this statute being in tension with the common law that's developed around the definition of reasonable accommodation or undue hardship?
Well, since you're looking right at me, Representative, yeah. I'll take a shot at that. The standard that is in this is actually identical to the standard that's in our wage and hour administrative rules and the disability statute, and so I think there's no difference in the standard. All we're doing is extending it to a new area of protection. Right. With respect to whether it's contradictory to case law, I wouldn't say that it's contradictory. I would say that first of all, this protection did not exist in private situations, and so there's not a comparison. If you compare it to cases that were decided on First Amendment, I would say it's consistent with the types of balancing test that you see in those constitutional cases. Not identical, but certainly consistent. But the most important thing is it's completely consistent with the other areas of protected class discrimination that we have in Oregon statutorily.
I might also say, Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, one of the reasons that the word reasonably accommodating was added, I think the three places it was added at the suggestion of Associated Oregon Industries in by the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think it's on page 1, line 10, line 20, and then at the top of page 2 in line 1, where it has reasonably accommodating, and reasonable accommodation. That actually does align it perfectly with the disability statute that Commissioner Avakian referenced. So there's nothing in that statute today that covers free exercise of religion in the workplace, but the standard of reasonable accommodation, as well as the undue hardship reference in here, is consistent. So there's a, as Commissioner Avakian said, the balancing test is known, even though it's being applied not to employees with disabilities, but to employees in terms of the free exercise of religion.
Chair, Commissioner Avakian, it's good to see you here. The question about enforcement, you and I had a chance briefly weeks ago to talk about enforcement of civil rights generally, and I'd posed a question about the Attorney General's efforts to add civil rights enforcement within the Oregon Department of Justice, and not asking necessarily to comment on that whole area, and I'm still trying to figure out what the smartest way to think about that is. As it relate to this statute, do you imagine that if that were successful, that this would be the kind of thing the Department of Justice would be taking on? Do you imagine this would stay within Boley or some other place I'm missing? Talk to me a little bit about enforcement to the extent it's even relevant in your mind.
Under current law, I think the statutes are quite clear that the Civil Rights Division at the Bureau of Labor has jurisdiction over 659.030. Period.
Thanks.
Representative Stigler.
And I'm not positive who it was who talked about this. It was either Speaker Hunt or Commissioner Avakian regarding the bona fide religious organizations. And I guess my question goes to how is that determined and who determines that? I mean, we can become either really prescriptive or we can be fairly open and broad in this, and I just want to get some sense of how that determination is made. Or anybody wants to take a shot at it.
Madam Vice Chair, this bill is really more in reference to individuals. So in terms of, you know, being attached to any specific denomination, actually constitutional law already says that it boils down to an individual's convictions and whatever that person perceives their religion to be in its narrowest form. So it all boils down to an employer following through the process of, you know, is this an undue hardship or is it not?
Follow up, Mr. Which sort of brings me around to the real point of what I'm asking, and you set that up perfectly. So really it is not related to having to identify a particular religion or particular religious belief other than identifying this is my, I mean, it's more of a personalization of that, if I'm...
That's the way I am for you.
I just wanted to make sure that that's what we were, and that it really was coming down to more the crux of the person and their relationship with the employer.
This bill will affect, just to add to that, will affect, Madam Vice Chair, will tend to affect religious minorities more so than perhaps religious majorities in the workplace, but the bill does benefit all faiths. So I thought I'd add that.
Cameron.
Thank you. Just to clarify here, so what I just heard on the definition of religious is what the individual thinks it is versus this, and I want to make sure that we're talking about language that's been adapted from disability statutes and how those are defined, what's a disability versus what I thought I just heard was the religious statute is going to be based on the individual's perception. How are we going to define that?
I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the parallels to the disability statute are really in the employer protections portion of the bill. In terms of reading from the disability employment law statute in 659A.112, the employer does not make reasonable accommodation to the known physical or mental limitations of an otherwise qualified person with a disability who is a job applicant or employee unless the employer can demonstrate that the accommodation would impose an undue hardship on the operation of the business or the employer, and then goes down into the parallel standards that are outlined here. The protections, because you have a balance here between protections for employees, free exercise, protections from employers in terms of not imposing an undue hardship on the operation of the business in line 20 and 21, and then on page 2, specifically going on and defining an undue hardship as something that requires significant difficulty or expense. Those are very parallel standards with the disability statute. Obviously, the individual side of the protections are different because the type of accommodation is different with, you're dealing with different issues. You're dealing with often physical issues with the disability, whereas these are leave, when leave can be used, what clothing can be worn in the workplace that's attendant of that person's religion. The parallel points are for the employer protections.
Mr. Chair, if I might take an add to the speaker's answer there. I think part of what you were getting at, Representative, as well, was how do you make sure somebody just doesn't make up some religion that isn't based in anything and then get all the benefits that the statute provides? We haven't had a statute like this before, so there isn't a body of case law in Oregon or any other statute to reference, but there certainly are numbers of cases in federal and state courts from around the country that have helped to define what a closely held bona fide religious belief is as opposed to something made up just to get benefits. You see it in terms of tax court decisions. You see it in terms of First Amendment decisions. And so I'm very confident that if the Bureau is faced with that type of a situation, that there is a good body of law for us to craft a good solution on that protects employers and maintains the right. And if I could, to Representative Smith, let me add something to the question that you asked me about jurisdiction. There is a role of jurisdiction in the Attorney General's office. It should be noted to make sure the record is completely full. The Attorney General does represent us on appeal as our lawyer on cases and could in one of these, as well as 659-030. The Attorney General does have the statutory jurisdiction to file a claim through the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Thanks.
I just want to add one more thing. The 319 cases that we have mediated in the last 5 years are all tied to bona fide religious faiths, so 100% across the board. So religious minorities specifically, and also including Baptists and Catholics, Muslims, Seventh-day Adventists, you name it, Jews. It affects all. Because they all come up with or have very solid beliefs that are tied to their religious faith put forward by their church and their church tenants.
Okay. Thank you, panel.
Chair. Sure.
Mr. Wilson and Ms. Palooza.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. Our official position on the bill is, in fact, neutral. We came to that conclusion due to the amendments that were put on the Senate side in the bill, which made called for a reasonable accommodation as opposed to just a simple accommodation on the part of the employer. In the original Senate Bill 786, an employee could have demanded any number of unreasonable accommodations, and the employer would have been forced to comply or faced with a state suit. By creating a reasonable accommodation standard, the employee has a duty to cooperate with an employer's good faith effort to accommodate, and that was our major issue with the bill. But I do want to highlight that there are some policy discussions that need to be made around this bill that I think would make it more suitable for employers. And they are highlighted in the Dash A3 amendments that we have asked for. Now, these were supposed to be three separate amendments, and they came back as a single amendment, but I want to address all three points separately. First, the issue of federal case law as it applies to religious accommodation. Federal case law in a federal court case of Cloutier versus Costco Wholesale said that there is a de minimis impact that is required for an employer to show undue hardship under federal Title VII claims. The plaintiff in this case, Cloutier, was a member of the U.S. Church of Body Modification. And the reason we take this seriously is because Cloutier actually prevailed at the EEOC level. So at some level, this was deemed a bona fide religion. The tenets of this religion required facial piercings, visible tattoos, things that Costco did not want on the front lines as folks who represented their company in a very public way. The case law that came out of that was that a company under federal standards had a right to protect its public image, even in light of federal Title VII religious accommodation protections. And so the first part of this Dash 3 amendment seeks to address what I would consider maybe absurd outcomes or outcomes that are perceived to be way out there, which is your frontline folks who, as part of a religious accommodation, would ask you for facial piercings or tattoos or things that might be beyond the pale. And that's what we're trying to achieve that comport with federal case law in that instance. The second issue is the issue of collective bargaining agreements. The landmark case in this that established a de minimis burden for employers in as it relates to claiming undue hardship was the Hardison versus TWA case in the 70s, which was a Supreme Court case. Under that, TWA had a labor agreement in which Hardison asked for to take his holy day off, but under the labor agreement, he did not have the seniority to take that day off. the court ruled basically under federal law that you could not violate an employer's basically labor scheme in order to accommodate the Title VII protections. And the purpose of putting in this amendment is that I want to comport as much as possible with federal case law established through the Supreme Court as it relates to labor agreements, collective bargaining agreements, labor structures that what might preclude an employee from being accommodated on from taking certain days off. And then the final issue addressed in the amendment is the simple issue of employee threshold, and that is federal law, federal Title VII protections apply to businesses with 15 or more employees. It is our understanding that Senate Bill 786 applies down to the first employee. I think that this is a pretty significant hurdle if you're talking about a small company, 3, 4, 5 employees, to put this regulation on them that they're not even subject to federally, but now you're creating a state regulation. I want to make clear we don't oppose the bill, but I think these are three pretty significant policy discussions that need to be had in the context of this bill, and it would not surprise me that small employers greet this bill less than enthusiastically.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenna Kaluza, and I'm the state director for the National Federation of Independent Business here in Oregon. We have a little over 7,000 members here in Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I am here in opposition to Senate Bill 786 as written. This bill would require that small businesses, even those with one employee, to accommodate for religious observance unless they prove undue hardship. It is our opinion that requiring a business with such few employees to go through the burden of proving undue hardship will damage small businesses in this state. This type of accommodation is more difficult for small business, and we believe exempting companies with 15 or fewer employees speaks to our main concern with this bill. We support the Dash 3 amendments that we submitted and would like you to consider the adverse effects Senate Bill 786 will have on small business. In the Dash 3 amendments, it would require that companies with 15 or more employees be required to make this accommodation, and it would exempt out less than 15 employees, as Dale just mentioned. Just 2 weeks ago, House Joint Resolution 43 passed out of the House floor. This bill, House Joint Resolution 43, recognizes the importance of Oregon small businesses to the economy and resolves that small businesses will be taken into account when considering and enacting legislation. We would ask that you guys would take this into consideration today. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to take any of your questions.
Question. Representative Smith.
And this may be unanswerable, and that's fine. To the extent it's decided law, I'm trying to imagine cases that might come up that we might not think are absurd. Might not be an internet religion, you know, that we just didn't feel we wanted to see as cognizable, but that nonetheless might pose a significant problem, just so we understand a little bit the texture of the decision we're making. The one case that came to my mind was a burqa that covers the face. Do we have any case law, because I'm unfamiliar with the area, perhaps too large a degree, do we have any decided case law on how that is viewed, or does it just merely depend upon the job and we can't know much more than that?
Thank you, Representative Smith. We certainly don't have state case law because this is the implementation of a new law. Federally, the de minimis standard includes an employer's right to protect their public image. To me, as far as I know, that's the defining standard. And so at that point, it's really up to the employer to decide whether the burqa is consistent with the image that an employer wants to portray or not. And so it's largely at the discretion of the employer from existing case laws, what I would answer.
JL, in answer to my question, I think I understood Commissioner Avakian to say that under our statutory scheme, a collective bargaining agreement would take precedence over a reasonable accommodation argument. Does that satisfy you as far as that issue is concerned?
Thank you, Chair Barker, Representative Garrett. It's the first I'd heard of it, and I was pleased to hear that. I'm not sure our own counsel was as optimistic, and I'm guessing that counsel may have raised that issue when we asked for that amendment, but... Yeah, it certainly was heartening to hear that, sir.
further questions. Representative, maybe, I don't know, Jail, I read this through a police, fire, emergency medical people. Some of them are private, some of them are public. If they have, don't want to work certain days has come up, then that burden would fall on those who didn't have that to work every Saturday for or to work every Sunday so that they could accommodate someone else. And I have a concern how that would possibly play out.
Well, I understand, I know that that 786 seeks to set a higher bar than the de minimis standard that exists federally, but under the federal case law on this bill, it says that de minimis basically captures an employer's cost in the form of lost efficiency or higher wages or even causing coworkers to shoulder a plaintiff's share of potentially hazardous work. So that was certainly contemplated in federal case law. It is my understanding that this bill seeks to raise that bar a little higher.
Please,
thank you, Mr. Chair. JL, isn't there federal law coming on this soon? Or has it been addressed, the religious part on this? Is it that's going to change what we're doing here? Is that part of the problem?
Representative Barker and Representative Wisden, not that I know of. In terms of pending federal legislation, I don't know of any.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Or another question, really. Hearing the testimony we did today from Boley, will Boley be putting out policy to implement this so they could put in their policy the fact that what Representative Garrett talked about as far as the union contract having in play here?
I do believe that is an issue that could be addressed in rule, yes.
Follow up to that.
Follow up.
How about our other concerns that the amendment that was not accepted, could they be addressed in the rulemaking?
I don't know what would preclude that, so yeah.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Cameron.
This could be for either of you on page 2, line 10 of the bill. This is talking about the possible exemptions or the factors that would be considered in determining whether accommodation needs to be required or not.
For example, on line 10,
who would determine the overall financial resource of the employer, and specifically, because we heard testimony to the overall size of the business, maybe 15 employees or whatever, who's going to determine whether what those resources are and what the size of the business is, and when an employer is facing trying to make a decision?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barker, Representative Cameron. I know what you're getting at. In this case, Boley enforces, so it would be Boley that takes that into consideration. I mean, admittedly, that has always made us nervous when you have agencies making subjective judgments about an employer's size or their ability to do something. That's always made us a bit nervous.
Follow up for me. So, employee files a complaint, there's an investigation done, gets to this point, Boley is determining whether the company has financial resources that were sufficient to make that accommodation. Is that what I'm hearing?
Representative Cameron, that is my understanding.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, panel. I'll be hearing on Senate Bill 786 and go to a work session on Senate Bill 786. Move it.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 786. I suppose we haven't amended it to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Was amended in the Senate.
As amended in the Senate.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 786A to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I have to apology to the speaker, but I supported this, but I didn't realize there was this much opposition, and I am a member of NFIB, and my organization is opposed to it. I'll be opposed.
State, thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Schiltz?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitnett?
Nay.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, before you hit the gavel, I need to declare a potential conflict of interest as an IM employer.
Okay. Motion carries. We'll leave the carrier open in case the speaker would like to carry the bill. Check with him.
Clarify that.
Sure.
I'm a member of the limited liability company that employs.
I think that's a big enough class that you wouldn't need to, but that's fine to declare it. It won't hurt. Okay.
I did some paperwork to get my name on the bill.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 687.
Senate Bill 687A transfers abandoned property from a lawyer trust account to the Oregon State Bar for the benefit of funding legal services program, requires report to Department of State Lands indicating property is a lawyer trust account, forwards any claims on the property to the Oregon State Bar, and requires rulemaking by the Department of State Lands and Oregon State Bar. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal, with no statement issued.
Sylvia Stevens, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Sylvia Stevens, General Counsel at the Oregon State Bar. The bar strongly supports Senate Bill 687 as part of our ongoing efforts to stabilize funding for legal aid in Oregon. As many of you may know, Oregon lawyers are required to hold all client funds that they are holding for a client in a trust account. Most of these trust accounts are what we call IOLTA accounts, which stands for Interest on Lawyer Trust Accounts, and that interest is collected and paid by the banks to the Oregon Law Foundation and used to fund legal services in Oregon. Historically, interest from those accounts has funded about 10% of legal aid needs every year, but this amount is dropping, and we believe that by directing the abandoned funds in lawyer trust accounts to the bar to be used for legal services programs will help make that some of that gap rather than have that money go to the Department of State Lands where it currently goes. In the materials that we're handing out, the written testimony, there's some statistics there that show you the gap that has been growing between the money to provide it. I don't want to read all of that to you, but I think it suffices to say that there isn't enough money, there isn't enough legal services to go around in the best of times, much less in the kinds of times we're facing right now. There are legal aid offices in the state that have already closed due to lack of funding. We don't anticipate that the money that will come from lawyer trust accounts will provide enough funding to open any of those offices, but they certainly will help to fill the gap. We recognize the importance of adequately funding education and the importance of the abandoned property going to the state lands, but we also believe it's critically important that children and families have access to basic legal needs. And given that the interest on lawyer trust accounts is already going to support legal services, we believe it makes sense that those same funds, when abandoned by clients, also be used for the same purpose. Thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Shields.
Questions about where these funds might go otherwise if they didn't go to legal aid?
I'm sorry.
Were there any conversations in the bar about other places these funds might go if they didn't go to legal aid?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, no. Okay. No, this was just, lawyers have asked over the years when they call and say, what do I do with the abandoned funds? They always want to know if they can send it to the bar, and we say, well, no, you have to do this other. So this is the only alternative we've discussed.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 687 and open a work session on Senate Bill 687. A.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I'm sorry that I don't know, and I should have asked. I don't think I was. Did I get lobbied on this? I'm not sure if I got lobbied, but the school gets, they get their, they get the interest.
Come back up, please.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Stevens. I apologize. The school gets the interest So why didn't we do this so you get the interest and not the money up front? Because that makes a bigger pot, and that helps the schools, the pot's bigger. In other words, this goes into state lands. State lands.
This money will go directly to the Oregon State Bar. Chair Barker and Vice Chair Wisman. The Department of State Lands, when we discussed this with them, they did not want to have a pass through because of the administrative. It will come. Lawyers will pay it directly to the bar. Okay. They will report to the Department of State Lands. If there is ever a demand for the money, then, because I think the State Lands Department will include the names of those clients in their published things about we've got your money, they will then direct those to the bar and we would reimburse people. But the money will not go to the department.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
Okay, Council, our staff summary sheet says it goes to the currently abandoned property goes to Department of State Lands.
Currently it does.
Currently, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're changing that, and it's not going to go through state lands at all.
That's right.
And is the property usually cash, or is it land?
It is. Money. I've never been aware of any other abandoned property that lawyers hold. I suppose there could
follow
be some.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Do you have an idea of how much money we're talking about?
I'm not positive. I understand it's about $10,000 on average.
Okay, forget it.
We're not talking. Well, I was going to say, this isn't exactly.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Yes, yeah.
Ms. Stevens, as I understand it, these funds would be held in basically in perpetuity by the bar, and the interested would be.
Parker and Representative Siegel, that is not the plan. The idea is that they are allocated to us to be used.
Okay.
And we're taking the responsibility that if we ever have to refund it to somebody that we will do that. But we're not going to hold it and accumulate interest. There's not enough money to grow any interest.
Okay. Thank you very much, Stephen. Okay. We haven't got a work session. Okay. So we're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisniewski.
I move Senate Bill 687 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisniewski moves Senate Bill 687 as amended to the floor of a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Crater.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett? Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Stiegler, would you carry that for us, please?
Sure.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to next open a public hearing on Senate Bill 303. We have a large number of people signed up, so we're going to be using the egg timer today, and we ask you to limit to your time to 3 minutes. Well, the little red light will be flashing.
Yeah.
And if other people already said what you have to say, it would be helpful if you didn't need to say it again. We don't have any stuff yet. Your call.
Senate Bill 303A adds nonprofit animal care agency that has maintained an investigation department for 5 years and has officers commissioned as special agents by the governor to the definition of law enforcement unit, clarifies that training from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training will be paid for by the animal care agency. There's no revenue or fiscal impact for this bill.
Okay, first I'd like to ask Marilyn Lawrence to come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. and although the policy discussion of this bill is beyond the scope of our agency, because Senate Bill 303, as amended by the Dash A amendments, proposes a change within the enabling statutes of our department, we wanted to provide you with a brief technical background about the effect of the proposal as it relates to our agency's current practices and our relationships with the limited number of individuals working for humane investigation agencies who would be covered by the bill. Specific individuals who are employed by these entities who have been commissioned by the governor are currently required to attend the DPSST basic police course as a condition of holding their governor's commission. Unless they are currently certified police officers who have already met basic training requirements. Before they can start at the academy, they must meet DPSST's minimum standards for police officers. Within the DPSST statutes, you'll find the definition of police officer on the bottom of page 2, I think, of the A engrossed bill and continuing up to page 3. It's very long, but for purposes of this bill, there are two relevant elements. One is that they must work full-time as a peace officer for a law enforcement unit. The second is that they must be commissioned by one of the listed entities within the definition. The humane special agents working for these listed humane investigation agencies meet a portion of the police officer definition because they are commissioned by the governor's office. But because the humane investigation agencies do not meet the definition of a law enforcement unit that's found within our statutes, they don't meet the other half of the test for being called a police officer within our statutes. Because they're not defined as a police officer within our statutes, they're not eligible to obtain certification if they've never been certified, or to retain it if they are a previously employed police officer who seeks employment with one of the humane investigation agencies. And for purposes of clarification, there have been two, the Oregon Humane Society and the Redmond Humane Society, that meet the definition that is in this bill. And we have working relationships with entities or with individuals from both of those organizations. In addition to not meeting the definition, or because they don't meet the definition of police officer, as I said, they can't obtain or retain their certification. Likewise, they are not subject to DPSST's minimum standards, and they are not subject to our enforcement actions if they engage in misconduct. Senate Bill 303A would make these humane investigation agencies law enforcement units within DPSST statutes only. It does not add those agencies to the list of entities who can commission the individual as a peace officer. That authority remains with the governor's office. The bill would define only those humane special agents who carry a governor's commission as police officers within DPSST statutes, then subject to all of DPSST's minimum standards, and then eligible for certification as police officers if the standards are met. The entities, as has been identified, that employ these individuals currently reimburse DPSST for the full cost of training, and that's handled within their agreement with the governor's office. This bill also makes that a statutory requirement, and therefore there is no fiscal impact to our agency. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Chair Harmon, and I'm trying. Waller,
Wallace.
Go ahead.
Dear Chair Barker, members of the House Judiciary Committee, my name is Austin Wallace, and I'm a special agent for the Oregon Humane Society,
and have been for 3 years. I began my career as an auxiliary police officer in 2001 after attending part-time New Hampshire Police Academy and was employed by the Portsmouth New Hampshire Police Department for several years as both the city animal services officer and as an auxiliary police officer. In total, I've been serving as an animal welfare officer for 9 years. My testimony today is in support of Senate Bill 303. Certification guarantees that the Oregon Humane Society has undertaken important steps so that the institution and its agents' performance complies with the standards accepted by the law enforcement community and is therefore also recognized statewide. With certification, the actions of a special agent will be held to standards of efficiency, effectiveness, honesty, legality, and additionally, with certification, if an agent's actions do not meet these standards, the necessary corrective and preventative measures can be taken with a process in place for periodic review by DPSST. The certification of Oregon special agents would more closely resemble that of Oregon's police officers, but with additional training and relevant to the investigation of animal crimes. All of this is paid for by the Oregon Humane Society with no expense to the state. Though Oregon Humane Society is a private organization, as special agents, we are law enforcement professionals who hold ourselves to the same high standards as our fellow police officers. We work with many law enforcement agencies to supplement and bolster their resources. However, we often end up leading the investigation with the local enforcement supporting us. I believe that the officers, deputies, and troopers of Oregon should expect all law enforcement personnel be held to the same standards of training and professionalism as established. Additionally, the citizens of Oregon should be assured that all law enforcement are held to an equally high standard.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Please.
My name is Sharon Harmon, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society, a local animal welfare organization in Oregon since 1868. We are not affiliated with the Humane Society of the United States, PETA, or anyone else, nationally or locally. This is a very, very simple bill, and as it is amended, all it does is increase the accountability and training standards for officers who are already commissioned by the governor. It does not empower new officers to bypass the governor's commission. It does not create greater authority. All it does is provide for greater accountability, training, and standards, and a little bit of oversight by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. So it adds a layer of government oversight to our officers that currently does not exist. The Internet's a beautiful thing, but it can also spread misinformation at the speed of light, perhaps faster. There's lots of talk on the blogs and the action alerts today based on the original Senate Bill 303. That's not what we're here talking about. It's the amended version, which is really just three lines on page two of Senate Bill 303. It doesn't create the Oregon Humane Society or the Redmond Humane Society, which does not have investigators at this time, and doubtful would comply after the bill is passed, should it be. It just creates it within the DPSST ability to provide that ongoing certification. Doesn't do anything more than that. It's easy to misconstrue, but it really doesn't. It's a simple bill. It's just three lines. It says that DPSST can provide for ongoing certification and training that currently isn't required of us by the state. It's required by our organization, but not by the state. This provides state accountability and oversight to our program beyond the governor's office already. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions? Representative Craig.
You have the governor's appointees, and then we heard earlier that would include what? Somebody from a Redmond Humane Society? What is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, at one point the Redmond Humane Society applied for commissioning. They had commissioned officers for a couple of years. They no longer have commissioned officers. The only agency eligible for this consideration is the Oregon Humane Society, not PETA, not the Humane Society of the United States, or any other entity in Oregon.
Hold on. When you are going to hire someone, who does the background checks of your people?
Representative Krieger, Mr. Chairman, we hire usually someone who does background checks for the Sheriff's, Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, for Hillsborough Police, and they do as an extensive background check for our investigators that is done for for instance, the Hillsborough Police Department. That expense is borne entirely by the Oregon Humane Society, as is all the training and credentialing and equipping of these officers. It comes at no cost to the state.
I wasn't interested in cost, but you've got a police agency or a sheriff or somebody that's doing your background checks, and I wonder what the standards were. Are the standards exactly the same?
The report, Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, the report I get is on the basis of about 2 weeks to 2 to 3 weeks of background investigation. They go back 10 years. They talk to, as best I can tell from the bills I get, everyone this person has ever met, and looking at the same standards of fitness, moral and ethical fitness.
Okay, that's all for now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Sigler.
I just want to be very, very clear here that as the version we have, the Senate 303A engrossed, the narrow desire out of this is to enhance training opportunities for governor-commissioned Humane Society agents. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stegler, that's exactly it. It is very narrow, more accountability and training by a state entity.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, please.
I guess what my concern here is this, and this has come to me through a variety of different venues, is that somehow we're not sort of trying to incrementally expand the jurisdiction of these agents to, quote-unquote, basically be police officers as we envision them out in the field. I appreciate and understand the training issue, but I want to be really clear that that's all that's being sought here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stegler, that is all and exactly what is being sought here. There is no expansion of authority, no expansion of power. It is simply a matter of training and accountability to a state agency.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I guess finally, I guess how many these are governor commissioned agents? Mm-hmm. So what are we talking about? What's the pool of folks that we're looking at potentially?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stegler, the Oregon Humane Society currently has 3 employed, 2 full time in the field, 1 administrator, myself.
Okay.
It is our hope to add another couple. It's a big state. We do statewide cruelty work.
Thank you.
Any further? Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Turner,
David Caldwell, and Sylvia Callwood. I'm sorry, David Caldwell and Sylvia Callwood.
Jim's back here.
Jim's back there. See who else shows up. I've got a real.
You're going to become police officer.
Please try to keep it under 3 minutes or about 3 minutes.
I'm going to volunteer to go first because mine is short and sweet. I'm Sylvia Calderwood from Lane County, and I'm a show dog breeder. I'm opposed to using the Humane Society or their employees to supervise or enforce animal regulations. The Humane Society and hobby dog breeders are diametrically opposed. We both would like to end abuse and neglect of animals, but our means to that end are opposites. Putting the Humane Society in charge of my kennel would be like putting Jerry Falwell in charge of Planned Parenthood. I'm asking you to vote no on SB 303 and keep personal agendas and nonprofits out of government.
And this bill, did you hear what they said about what this bill addressed was a very narrow thing just regarding training?
I would have objected to the original bill that put the Humane Society under the governor's control into my kennel.
Okay.
Having humane societies
is
a clear conflict of interest. I'm sorry. My name is David Calderwood.
Thank you.
28104 Spencer Creek Road.
That's fine.
Clear conflict of interest. There are various states that have done this. There are also lawsuits pending in these states as we speak challenging this. We expect that the lawsuits will be upheld. There have been clear abuses. I know of abuses in Florida that have taken place. And the reason there are abuses is, I'm going to do a little education here. We're fighting a war, and most people don't know it. It's not recognized by the general public or you as legislators, even though there's been plenty of warning and we've had plenty of signs. It's between animal rights and animal welfare. And in the handouts I've given you, I apologize, I only have 9 of them. I didn't know how many people were going to be here. I didn't even know what committee we were going to. Only found out about this bill a few days ago. Whoever doesn't get one, I would be glad to give them one. I have on the back page websites to go to find out the difference between animal welfare and animal rights. In order to be fair to your constituents, you must know the difference. Very few people do. The animal rights mindset is very deeply ingrained in some humane societies, not all. Some animal controls, not all. But I've personally witnessed some. I've known some of the animal rights people, and I know what their agenda is. I would hope you're aware of a group of radicals, animal rights radicals, known as the Family. Through an extensive undercover operation, they were captured, arrested, and put on trial in Eugene. Most of them are now in jail. One of them committed suicide because of his offenses. I would assume you're also aware of Schumacher Furs in Portland that was run out of business because of radicals and the problems these radicals caused in downtown Portland. I bet you're not aware that the family of one of these radicals, known as Michael Scarpetti, a.k.a. Trey Arrow, which you may have heard of, received $20,000 from a radical group. Now, I realize we've heard that the Oregon Humane Society is not part of PETA. I understand that. However, there are people with this type of mindset that work for these kinds of agencies. The family received $20,000 from PETA. While he was still underground and on the run from police when he was in Vancouver, Canada. This is not the first time these radicals have been supported by a supposed animal-loving organization. We still have plenty of these radicals around. We have them in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, Ashland, wherever, and points in between. I've met them. I've worked with them. I know some of them personally. I've been physically threatened by one of them a number of times because of my opposing views on animal welfare. In Eugene, our radicals have begun a campaign denigrating anyone working for Lane County Animal Services. We call it LCAS. They worked diligently to get the previous director fired. They're now doing the same with the current supervisor who took over from the fired director. They've stated that they want the country to close LCAS, the county to close LCAS and let them run it because they feel they can do a better job. They've even gathered the funds to send one of their own to a seminar learning how to run such a facility. In other words, they want it privatized. That's what we're looking at here, privatizing. Now, it may be only a few agents, but it's a step. The same as other animal legislation is a step towards, and it may seem way out there, but it is way out there, total animal liberation. 303 will set up a very dangerous situation in Oregon. The radicals who are obsessive and already deeply involved in rescue and humane societies all across the state are poised to push the radical agenda on an unsuspecting public and legislature. In places like Florida where it's been tried, they've taken over animal controls and problems have ensued in every instance. Remember, we're talking about not only our beloved animals.
Mr. Collarwood, you're running over a little bit. And okay. If you were to recall, this bill is very narrow. The change in this bill is very narrow.
It's a step.
And requires additional training for those agents.
What's happening is we're the people that run the dog shows. The dog show can bring in $1 million in a weekend in a community. You're running us out. You're going to hurt the economy of the state. And one of the handout I gave you on the economic effect of dog shows is from the AKC.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, we heard some testimony earlier about some confusion. I think I'm one of the ones that's confused because looking at these two lines that are added, I don't see anything which would preclude HSUS. An organization outside of Oregon as being appointed as one of these humane special agents. You're the legal folks. Perhaps I'm just confused on this. I mean, that changes some things if it's limited to just internal Oregon, and if it truly is limited just to adding more training. Regardless, I share some of the concerns of some of the other people you've heard with merely having humane special agents that are appointed by some of the local animal control groups. I represent the Feline Conservation Federation. We're the oldest feline group in the country, over 50 years of breeding, and we've seen similar things in other states. I think I spoke in my testimony to some of the bad things that have happened to Arizona and with Arizona's citizens. I'm sorry if I'm jumping around here. So even if these laws you feel are good laws and will work under the current administration, I'm concerned also going forward as to what the next governor may do with appointing, even if the current governor is only appointing local people. Will the next governor still appoint only local people? And these local people, they've already said in testimony that they don't believe that citizens should have exotic animals and exotic pets. As a private owner of an exotic animal, that gives me great concern. Some of these individuals feel that that anyone who has an exotic cat or an exotic animal is already being abusive. These aren't the type of people that I want to have police powers if they're already feeling that I'm guilty just because I have an exotic pet. And again, I apologize for not having my my thoughts in order here. But I'm just not seeing where this limits this bill in any way. Thank you.
The bill's already in place, and the amendment is requiring additional training. So thank you very much for your testimony, panel. Next call, Dennis, looks like Crane, possibly, from Clackamas County. Okay. Oh, okay, sorry. Tom Buchholz and Susan McMillan.
I'll get right into it. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Ganeau. I'm a resident of Milwaukee, Oregon. I live in the unincorporated area of Clackamas County within the urban growth boundary. As such, I'm part of the Enhanced Service District. We don't have any particular direct police in our area. We rely on enhanced service from the county sheriff. I'm here opposed to Senate Bill 303 because I think it's poorly written and overly broad. If you look at the wording of a private nonprofit animal care agency, the wording we've heard today is it's directed at Oregon Humane Society. This does not limit that. I've done some research, and they say PETA falls under this definition. They are a nonprofit organization. They have an animal welfare investigative unit that's been in existence for 15 years. They also run a shelter. They happen to kill 90% of their animals, but they run a shelter. They fall under this definition. This definition is overly broad. I also think creating a private entity as a law enforcement unit is bad for Oregon. We're talking about a public safety standards and training, and we're taking a private organization to give them the rights of a law enforcement unit. I'm against that completely. I understand that the officers need their training, but I think this is the wrong way to go about it. We should create a different bill or something else that addresses the officers without making Oregon Humane Society or another private nonprofit agency a law enforcement unit.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. They're already in place, and that unit is already in place, and this just addresses the training. So,
Chair, I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
Because what we're doing is you're defining them now as a law enforcement unit, and a law enforcement unit in other parts of the regulations and the administrative rules have other rights and abilities that are not currently in place.
Yeah. Okay.
Please. Yes. My name is Tom Buchholz. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard today. I'd like to first call your attention to July 6, 2005 letter from the Legislative Council to my representative, Wayne Scott, where he is told, we do not know what authority under which they are commissioned. What they're talking about is Randy Covey, who used to be from the Oregon Humane Society. My concern here is in this bill, it says that commission as special agents by the governor, but it doesn't state the authority. It leaves it up to arbitrary. I mean, they only have one authority that they can be commissioned under. That's 131.805. There needs to be, the statute needs to be included in the commission statute for clarity. Also, the Senate committee staff measure summary contains an important error. The summary states, they, Humane Society officers, are certified by DPST standards and training. This is not true. There needs to be a note, I suppose that you guys will have a House Judiciary Committee. I think there needs to be a note noting this error.
It says, but are not recertified as public safety officers in the summary. So, however, when officer certification expires, they retrain with DPSST, but are not recertified.
It says in my copy here, they are certified by the DPSST safety and standards and training as condition of their commission.
No,
it's under background.
You must have a different. But must be a different.
The Senate is reading this one here.
This is the Senate one here.
Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay, it's in the Senate one. My senator made a vote based on that information. Okay, one final concern is the October 29th, 1937 Attorney General's opinion of the state of Oregon. And it states, when it talks about section 67105, which is earlier version of 131805, it says the governor is hereby authorized to employ special agents. Well, it goes on, and it states here towards the end, it says, but it does not apply to special agents appointed pursuant to 67105 Oregon Code 1930, except in special cases provided for that action when specially appointed for such purposes and to extent they are authorized. And it goes on, he submits this little form, and it says here that I commission him as a special agent for the state of Oregon without state compensation. Where the Attorney General then says, it would appear to indicate that your intention is issuing it as to create a general or roving commission. That means like, you know, enforcing the general laws. And he is told, and your attention is called to the fact that the statute does not authorize the granting of such commissions, but limits the exercise and powers thereof granted to you to specific cases, and provides that reasonable salaries shall be paid for services rendered. That's an Attorney General's opinion. And I've also included the grandfather of them all, which is Chapter 9, 105 statute. It's the states the governor is hereby authorized to employ special agents for the apprehension and conviction of criminals. Section 2 says that that there be appropriated out of the general funds of the state treasury the sum of $10,000 for 2 years commencing to be used by the governor in payments for the salaries and expenses to such special agents as he may employ by him as provided by Section 1. And then we have Section 3, which talks about how the Secretary of State shall pay these guys. So,
okay.
What I would think that needs
you're already,
to be done.
Sir, you're 4 minutes, so you're over. If you could sum it up, please.
Big pardon?
If you could come to a summary.
Well, I would like to see that the commission be put into the statute, number one. Number two, I think that it's being misused, the commission, and I think that you need an attorney general's opinion that could be sought by any of you and paid for by interested parties. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your testimony.
My name is Susan McMillan, and I'm from Douglas County, Oregon. I'm against this bill. I personally am a victim of what could happen. My family's been raising dogs for over 20 years. We live out in the country on a nice rural road. There's a woman that moved from somewhere else and now lives past us, and it came to her attention that we raised dogs. She could see them out in the runs playing. She first went to animal control and said, "You've got a puppy mill in Douglas County." Animal control said, "Where?" She told them where we were located. They said, "Ma'am, we've been out there, and they meet all the guidelines, and they're... Yes, they raise dogs. You may not like it, but there's nothing you can do about it." So then she went to the local newspaper and wrote terrible articles about us, which 99% of them were lies, that we overbred our dogs, that they weren't socialized, that, you know, that they were born there and died there. We sold to pet stores, which we do not. I'm not USDA licensed. We've never sold to a pet store. We don't sell to brokers. We're just a family-run operation. We only do private sales so that we can meet the people that get our dogs. I spent $13,000 last year in veterinarian bills on my dogs, taking care of them so that they were properly taken care of. It's a big investment. I work from morning till night with my dogs. So then she went to, she was dissatisfied with the fact that nobody in the community had an issue with us. We have people from the community that bring their newspapers to us and leave them in our driveway, you know, to help us with the bedding of the pens and stuff. We've got very good rapport with our community. So she went back. So then she decided she was going to get hold of the animal rights group in Utah that they have a TV program where they go in and they do the sensationalized busting the puppy mills. So our head animal control officer received a letter about this, and so the head man that doesn't even dirty his feet going to kennels, you know, he takes care of the men that do come and check out the kennels. He came to our place, and he said, I this woman will not let this go. She's very activist against you guys even existing. I need to personally walk through, even though our files all state that you're in complete compliance with everything. So he walked through, and he said, may not be the fanciest, but it's certainly one of the nicest that I've seen. I will have no problem writing a letter to her, you know, to try to dissuade her and stop her. So then she goes and she finds out that the House, the 2470 bill was going to take place. Writes another letter to the newspapers. Gets hold of Scott Backstead, who's the president of the American Humane Society, who is a neighbor of ours. Actually, we live in the same town. And so word is, in the grapevine, that they're coming to our house with an agenda to shut us down because we're, quote-unquote, a terrible puppy mill. And so I'm against this bill because I would hate to see them get any more power than they already have. I'm an American citizen. I have no issues with animal control coming out and checking out our facilities. We always comply, and if they have any suggestions, we act on them immediately. No problem with AKC coming through. They inspect us once a year. We have no issues with them. But I do have a problem with people with an agenda coming in and basically taking our livelihood away from us. And that's where I stand on it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for anybody in this panel? Thank you very much. Julie Dalby, Roland Sonnenberg, and Lauren Henry, please. Please go ahead.
My name is Julie Dalby, and please bear with me. I didn't have the forethought to put all this down on a piece of paper in a nice, orderly fashion before coming here. I would like to ask a question, actually, before I made my statement. I read a copy of the bill and amendment a short while ago, and it indicated to me that these people from a humane society would be authorized to carry a pistol or a weapon. Is that correct?
No.
Not because I saw something to that effect.
No. Yeah. No. It's not in this one.
Okay. Well, in any event, a little over 3 years ago, I had an experience similar to the last person who spoke up here, and a neighbor who had a beef with me contacted the local humane society and reported that I had thin cows. I had Jerseys. I don't know if people here are aware of what the average dairy cow looks like, but particularly Jerseys, you can't make them fat. It's not possible. It's not the way they were intended to be. Extra food goes into their udder, not into their body as fat. They're not a beef animal. A Humane Society officer showed up at our gate on a Saturday morning and indicated what she was there for. My husband, who was the only person home at the time, basically said, here are the cows. You can see them from the road. She could see them very clearly. Our property is such that there is not a pasture on it that is not visible very, very clearly from the road. She could see that they were, eating, in decent condition, and that there was hay in front of them and also hay in a barn that was also visible from the road. She insisted that she needed to come onto the property. My husband indicated that that was not something he was comfortable doing. Not because we have anything to hide, but because he figured that this was probably going to lead to problems, as he knows what the agenda of most of the Humane Society are. She told him that if she was not allowed onto the property, she would come back with a deputy. Knowing what we know now, he simply should have said, fine, you do that, because obviously that would not have changed anything, because without a search warrant, they had no probable cause to come onto our property. Unfortunately, he allowed her to come onto the property. The real agenda for coming onto the property was they knew we were dog breeders. This officer proceeded to walk around our kennels, not ask my husband any questions, and then without issuing any citations or making any suggestions or indicating that there were any problems, she left. The following Tuesday, we received a visit from the county dog control officer and were cited. We ultimately went to court over that citation, which was running a commercial kennel without a license, and there is no such animal in the county that we live in, so I don't really know how we could be cited for it, but we were. We went before a judge. The judge found in our favor. A short while later, he came and he cited us again. Now, yes, I realize this is the county officer, not the local Humane Society, but in the end, we were ultimately cited a total of 4 times, went before a judge 3 times for the same thing, always won. They always found in our favor. The last time we were cited, since he knew the judge was going to find in our favor, he had us go before the dog board, which had to dismiss the charges because of a judge's finding. In the course of all of the discovery that took place prior to going to court, we had a copy of the Humane Society officer's report, which indicated that there were, I believe it was 3 times as many dogs on the property in her estimation than what there truly were, that we were a puppy mill, and by the fact that there was not a single puppy on the property, there wasn't a pregnant bitch on the property, and there wasn't actually a dog, I think, under the age of 9 or 10 months, that the dogs had no food or food dishes visible. We feed our dogs a raw diet. We don't have bags of kibble around because of that. We do have 2 freezers full of meat. She never asked us once.
And can I ask you to summarize, please?
I will. My point is, if these people don't have enough training to do even basic things, and if their organizations are not using enough of this oversight that they say they have in order to prevent this sort of thing from going on, how is giving them any more power going to help anybody?
Well,
it gives them the opportunity to cause more problems and more. It's more of a problem of abuse of power, I believe.
Okay, thank you. But this bill talks about giving them more training.
They're already under empowerment.
I understand that, but okay. they're not doing well enough with the training that they have. I don't see how giving them. I honestly don't. They're not taking what the training that they supposedly have and doing well with it. I don't see how giving them more training is going to actually do any real good if they can't deal with what little they have at this point.
Okay, thank you. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Roland Sonnenberg, and like some of the people who came before me, I am here in opposition to this bill, but really it's a little hard to explain. Essentially, I think what happened is the amended version of this bill is not so much the problem as the amended version of this bill called everyone's attention to an existing problem. And I think many of the people here today are testifying not really against 303, but against the existence of humane officers that have powers we don't think they should have. And I apologize, I'm not really sure what the right legislative process is. It may be that really we need to go draft a new bill that says, hey, we need to change this. But I think, like many of the people, essentially I am aware suddenly, and perhaps should have been long ago, but wasn't here when the governor was first empowered to create these agents, that there is a private police force that has a profound conflict of interest. And having a force of people who are empowered with imposing laws on dog owners, but that same group of people can seize dogs and essentially sell those dogs. And I realize they use words like adopt and rescue, but ultimately the Humane Society takes in a great deal of money from the dogs that they take from private citizens. And I think most people here are feeling that it is inappropriate to have a force that is simultaneously empowered to take one's property and then turn around and sell that property. And so additionally, you know, you've heard about the animal rights agenda, and I'm sure you'll continue hearing about it. And essentially, I'm not even saying that Oregon Humane is doing that, although there are a bunch of cases where private citizens would certainly say that's what's happened. But essentially, what I'm saying is we have a problem that this bill has called into resolution, which is there is an organization that theoretically has the power that they shouldn't have, which is the power to be able to come in, judge us, take our animals, and sell those animals, and that's clearly a conflict of interest. And so most of us, I think, would like to see something done to remedy that, and we are objecting to 303 kind of on concept that giving them DPSST certification implies some sort of codification that the state actually approves of this private police force, when in effect what we're saying is we don't think that it's a right force to exist already. And codifying that by saying, okay, we're going to give them DPSST certification, it's really not the certification that any of us are objecting to. It's the existence of that body and saying, hey, this is not okay, and there have been abuses that we feel are already unacceptable in this state, and we're essentially here to object to the continuation of that empowerment that these people be doing that, and basically to say we think that they should be empowered to educate and to investigate anything that's causing harm to animals. But when it comes time to search warrants or seizing animals, that's got to be an objective police decision, and it can't be a private group that potentially does have another agenda and that certainly has a profit motive. Even if that's not why they're doing it, it's just absolutely abhorrent to have the same group trying to weigh those things. And one last piece to that, we have very good neglect and abuse laws on the books for dogs right now, but many of them are very subjective, and they say things like every dog has to have continuous access to adequate exercise, which is conceptually great, but it means theoretically if my dog is in my living room and it doesn't have access to the outdoors, I'm technically breaking a law that says it has to have continuous access to exercise, which means theoretically a humane officer can come in and say, well, this dog is in the living room, it doesn't have adequate access to exercise, therefore we're going to seize this dog. And there have been many cases where ambiguous subjective laws like that have essentially been used to coerce people into giving up their property under threat of, well, we're going to file animal abuse charges if you don't give us your animals. And then you see those animals being adopted out a few days later, they're not underweight, they seem to be healthy, and it looks for all the world like essentially profit was a motive, not animal care. And I think that reality has terrified a lot of us, along with the animal rights agenda. And when we see this bill, we go, oh my God, this shouldn't have happened whenever it did happen. And one last quick thing. I totally understand that Oregon Humane is not PETA and is not in bed with HSUS, but 10 minutes ago, the director of HSUS in this state came in and talked to the director of the Oregon Humane Society on this bill, and that makes you kind of look askance and say, well, okay, they're not officially allied, but clearly, ideologically and practically, there is significant overlap and significant cause for those of us who have animals to be worried that their agenda could be forced on us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Thank you for your attention to this important bill. My name is Lauren Henry, and I'm a professional animal trainer with an animal science degree specializing in veterinary nutrition and immunology. I support the Oregon Humane Society. I have many friends there. I've donated my time, services, and money to help them help the animals of our state. I adopted animals from Oregon Humane. However, I oppose SB 303, similar to what Roland was saying, because it brought to light, I think, a very real problem in this state, and that is that I do not believe that private agents from a nonprofit group should have law enforcement authority and should not be given the standards and training of our current law enforcement agents. And I also do not believe that we should have a private humane law enforcement agency that has potential for monetary gain for using their power. So what I urge you to do is to understand that this needs more attention, to leave things as they are, establish a work group to study the interests of the private nonprofit groups with the police power, and make sure that the law enforcement is fair and impartial for all Oregonians, and that the power is limited to people that are here to enforce the law and not enforce their agenda. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's very nice. Thank you. Any questions? No. Okay, thank you. Susan Lamore and Jim Welsh.
Record.
I'm Suzanne Lemire from Columbia County. I'm opposed to the expansion of private law enforcement agency that doesn't have accountability to the normal law enforcement chain of command, and therefore they're not accountable to the public. Currently in Oregon, it is possible for someone to complain about my dogs and for someone to come out without a search warrant and demand access to my home, go through my home, any outbuildings they want, and if they want to, take my property, which is my dogs. And I am not reimbursed for that, and I really have no one at this point that I can go to and complain unless I spend thousands of dollars and go to a direct attorney. There's no oversight. There's no one to complain to. Where really what you've been hearing is terrorism against animal breeders of all kinds in the state that's happening right now. And it's being done every day. HSUS, Oregon Humane Society, different animal control agencies. You know, power can also breed corruption. And when they have the power to take the animal from you and then turn around and profit by it themselves, that is not correct. And I would really like to announce again that I am against the expansion of this private law enforcement agency, and I would like to see an anti-terrorism bill introduced here in the state of Oregon to protect animal breeders of all kinds. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, committee members, Jim Welsh and Oregon Cattlemen Association. We gave testimony on this bill to begin with, and we're very concerned. Even as far back as 2007, when we were going over some of the same issues. And the legislation did not pass. But the cattlemen are very concerned about a private nonprofit entity having police powers. You know, out in the country, in the far reaches of this state, where there isn't great population, but we all have animals. In my last count, even for me personally, was 26. And we realize that the Humane Society is not concerned about necessarily our cattle or our horses to a large extent. They're going to deal with the smaller animals. But we all have smaller animals. And the last thing we want is someone coming in a different uniform than what we're expected seeing, and that would be a state police uniform or a county deputy, county sheriff's department. We believe these should be, any humane agent should be under the authority of the county sheriff or the state police. Plain and simple. And that's how we told it in the Senate committee, Judiciary Committee. We still believe that is true, and it's bad policy moving them out to become, and because there's other pieces of legislation, they were asking for special warrants that's moving, that this is definitely going to broaden their authority. And a reference to this particular ORS gives us great consternation because we believe they are broadening their authority. We're not sure that entirely, but that's not where we think a private nonprofit organization should go. We believe there should be full training. If they're going to have police authority, then there should be full training. And they're only going to, under this statute, get partial. And they, as we read it, there would be an absence of certification and training, possibly, or a delay. So we believe it should still be as policy under the authority of sheriff or state police.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here representing Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. We testified in the Senate bill that if this bill is only about increased training, we are not opposed to that. We are neutral on that concept of giving increased training. The concern and not knowing the law enforcement statutes well enough to know whether or not by adding this language as a definition under law enforcement unit, if that definition section is referenced somewhere else in the law enforcement statutes, that those that would go back and give this private nonprofit association additional powers. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm concerned about that issue because many of our statutes reference other statutes for common definitional purposes. So that's why I felt it necessary to put that on the record, that the dairy farmers are not opposed to increased training, but if this does, in fact, broaden their authority because of the definitional section, we would be opposed to that concept. Happy to answer your questions.
Any sure. questions? Sure.
Greg? Oh, less of a question, Mr. Chair, but on line 24, a private nonprofit animal care agency. Private nonprofits don't create agencies. States do, counties do. It's a government-type entity, so the wording's wrong to start right off the bat. You know, clear back when I chaired this committee in 2005, there were some issues of this came up. In the last session, and basically last session, as you recall, they were really looking for police powers fully. And we didn't move that because we didn't. And what I see this doing is piece by piece taking us forward to full police powers for private individuals on private property. They had better never, ever come to my property. Because I'll cuff them, and they'll go to the county jail, and I know how to do it, and I know how to do it legally. So that's a challenge. Now, I take a look at, well, if this is really a need, Mr. Chair, why don't they give that money to the county sheriff? Let's hire a full-time deputy that's assigned to this, and let's have someone who's been fully trained, is accountable to your county sheriff or the state police or somebody, instead of this makeshift thing we're doing now. They could hire, the amount of money they're paying these people, they could hire people as it is now. So I'm not going to be in favor of this bill, Mr. Chair. I hope you don't move it. It's going to be a mistake. We will regret it.
Representative Westman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Welsh, did you enter the same testimony in the Senate for the committee?
I didn't give written testimony, no. And the only other reference I made is that we realize and certainly recognize the governor's authority to commission for whatever reason that the governor wants for public safety or for any kind of investigation. But we did not believe that was still the proper way to go about this. We still want the authority of humane special agents to be under authority of the Sheriff's Department or state police. Plain and simple.
Mr. West, I can't find, I had the staff summary sheet in the Senate, but Senator Wissett was at the committee that you testified, and he voted yes.
I
Representative Shields.
What was the vote coming out of committee in the Senate?
5-0.
5-0.
5-0.
In favor. Representative Smith.
And this entire hearing, I've had essentially the same question. The thought that almost all of the testimony we heard had to do with a set of general considerations that I'm not really sure apply to the statute that we're considering. And I'm looking at a staff measure summary that tells me not only the committee vote was 5-0, but the floor vote was 30-0. And maybe that's a mistake. And wondering what precisely I'm missing.
Nothing.
Okay. Thank you, panel.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
real quick. So somebody referred to the question of a law enforcement unit also means they're gone.
Okay.
I was going to ask, does anybody see that anywhere else in statute? Line 20, law enforcement unit also means.
Representative Cameron, I've never seen it anywhere else, and I would just note briefly that you see also there other agencies like the district attorney's office, which of course we all know they are not allowed to carry weapons or go onto private property without a warrant, things like that. So I don't read this as conferring any kind of authority beyond this kind of rulemaking issue within DPSST.
They'll be back.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, is the Farm Bureau not testifying?
No. Everybody's testified that's signed up, and a couple that didn't. Okay, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 303.
Oh. Can I answer his question, if you would like, about why there was
I have people that need to leave, so open a work session on Senate Bill 303.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 303A. To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 303A to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
if I may. I do have some concern with how this is worded. A private nonprofit animal care agency is wide open. It does not limit it to somebody in Oregon. So I'm going to be voting no today until I see a clearer picture of what this bill really does.
Thank you, Representative Cameron. Call the roll, please. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I'll be a no. I talked to the lobbyist for this, and I thought I was in support. I did not know that Cattleman was opposing it.
Okay.
And now we'll be a no.
Okay, thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krueger?
No.
Representative Olson?
Yep.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice
Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Rubin?
Yep.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Would you like to carry the bill? I'll carry the bill. Further business coming before the committee? Committee adjourned.